You would think it would be easier than it is. And that probably can be said about just about anything in life and everything in life. One of our big problems as human beings is that we expect things to work the way we want them to. That is, we expect life to be easy, right? And then when it's not, you hear us say something like, that's not fair. And there's something to recognizing that there is indeed an unfairness in the world that's not right. There is something wrong with the world. The world is broken. The world is sinful. Even Christians who believe this, though, can't really escape from that frustrating feeling when it isn't quite as it should be, when it isn't as easy as you thought it would be. And it's not as if I thought that putting together a sound studio in my home would be easy. I haven't thought that at all. What's amazing is I haven't really started to do that at all either. All I've really been attempting to do is plug one microphone into one soundboard into one computer and get it to record in a way where I can monitor it. And let me tell you, my friends, I have not had anything so humbling in all of my life. No, that's not quite fair. Humbling, yeah, I've done enough stupid things in life and been called on the carpet for them that I've been more humbled than this. But my goodness gracious, I have just been at pains. Last week there was no RAW. Why? Not because I couldn't have sat down and done a RAW. I did not want to give the 3 hours to banging my head against a wall to trying to figure out if I could just make sound go into a computer. And today I almost didn't do it again. I've actually, what time is it right now? Right now it is 1:05. I sat down, I believe it was around 11:30, and attempted to run the sound that runs every day just fine to KFUO radio through this little device called a Comrex on my desk. Tried to run that out of the headphone jack and into the microphone jack on my computer, and I tell you, You would think feedback, and then I wouldn't find it. And apparently one of the free softwares that I'm using, anytime you unplug anything, you need to reboot the entire thing. Otherwise, it doesn't read what the system is doing right. So, okay, Ocean Audio, you're pretty cool looking, but I'm not sure I'm going to be using you. We're giving a waveform, a little waveform, is that what it's called? Wave pad, a little test run right here. So far, it's pretty smooth already, although it's telling me that the recording is too loud and may be distorted when saved to file. So we're going to pause what I'm doing right now and double check on that. I'll be right back. Well, it looks like it sounds okay when I listen to it on a monitor feed, or you know, plugging my headphones into another jack so I can double check what the sound looks like. Oh, it's just infuriating. It looks okay, but if you're getting this and it's distorted, I'm a sinner. I'm a sinner and God is angry, I guess, because I just can't seem to get there. And so this is part of the issue with why Revelation just is off the table at the moment. As much as the number of people that have talked to me about RAW and the number of people that have talked to me about Revelation on RAW are kind of the same number. I don't think that you out there don't like the rest of the RAW shows. I hope not. I mean, I'm continuing to get you joining on Patreon, which is great. Makes me feel good. Makes me want to keep doing this. But I'm not getting any other feedback besides Patreon about any of the shows. So I don't know. But I'm with you. I want to get back into studying Revelation. But so if I've got about 3 hours a week on my Thursday mid-morning to mid-afternoon that I can generally give to making a one-hour podcast, 2 hours of that, which should ideally be studying and prepping for it. Well, right now, that 2 hours a week is given over to trying to plug a microphone into a microphone jack. And just, I must be the dumbest man alive. I cannot figure it out. I mean, the soundboard that I was using before, I actually ended up sending it back now to the place where I bought it from. Not I bought it from Amazon, but I went back to the manufacturer because I guess the headphone jack just doesn't work. I mean, that's the only thing I could figure out. Maybe I'm lying, and they just sent me a new one anyway. Oh my goodness. So my apologies to you on this. You know, I'm not really feeling guilt. Well, I am feeling guilty, but I'm not really like moping around the house. Oh, but I do feel like this is annoying. It's an annoyance to me, and I'm sure it's an annoyance to you. And God willing, I will make it through this, and we'll get back, right? We'll get back. The goal is video. The goal is audio and video. There's a lot of goals, but it all begins with figuring out a way that I can consistently plug a microphone into the computer and have it be recorded. And I just can't seem to get there. Heaven help me. So prayers, since prayer is magic, and the more people who pray for something to happen means the more likely it will happen. This is only because I am Tinkerbell, and you are people not clapping for me. So you need to be doing your clapping Tinkerbell prayers that you do believe that Jonathan Fisk can plug a microphone in, and then God will send his spirit juju down, and it'll all work, and then Raw will be back the way you've always wanted it to be. So I'm going to blame you. It's not me. It's not me. It's you. Yeah? Hear what I'm saying? All right. I knew you did. I knew you'd understand it once we talk this through. All right. So what I'm going to be trying to do today, since I don't really have content prepped, I haven't read for Revelation, and I want to get back into the AD series. I have a number of ideas for interviews. Adam Koontz wants to do a regular series on Ezekiel. Wolfmuller, we got the eschatology series we want to start doing again. Actually, he's going to be in town in a couple weeks, so hopefully when he's local, God willing, we'll figure out a way to get at least two of those recorded while he's in town. I got a couple other names of guys that I want to start some ongoing series with. I have an idea for, what do you think of this idea? You can let me know if you like it or not. I'm intending to have at least one, but maybe over time, each of my children. I want to interview them and or have them interview me on parenting and theology. So, you know, if you follow the Issues Etc. series on parenting, you might ask the question that was asked of me about 2 months ago now when I was speaking on the book Echo at an event at a congregation. And someone asked me, so how are your own children doing since you're here? And she didn't mean it like this, but it like cut me to the heart, and my sinful heart in guilt felt this, right? You know, since you're here telling us all how to raise our children with the faith, how are your children doing in the faith? And it was like, I don't know. No, I think I do know. I think they're doing okay. I think they could be doing better. They could be doing worse. I think I'm I think I am a failure. And if you're not feeling that you're a failure as a parent, then you're probably not trying very hard. But I thought it'd be interesting to like take them, you know, take the 13-year-old and the 11-year-old and the 9-year-old and see like, be like, so what do you know? You know, what have you learned? What do you think? Why are you a Christian? So I want to do that too. So that's all sort of planned. But most of these things are waiting on the moment where I don't need 2 hours of banging my head against a computer first to make it work. So today then, I'm going to try to kill two birds with one stone because there's another project that I am terribly frustrated that I have not been able to get to. I am enjoying very much my new work here in Rockford. The congregation is going through a number of significant challenges, but it's just been a blast in my own mind because they're good people who love the Word of God, and they're taking it on the chin with their head held high. And it makes it so much easier when you are a congregation that's not going to get snowflake-style offended at every little thing that happens, and you're willing to suffer with each other for the gospel. Man, you can do amazing things. And so I'm really enjoying that, but it has meant there's just a grand amount of groundwork that I'm having to do, administrative-style groundwork, things that are hopefully going to get balls rolling that'll keep rolling for many years, but it's taken a lot of time of most days and most weeks, a lot of thought, a lot of energy. So the other thing that I'm not getting to that I really desperately want to get to is the follow-up book to Echo, right? So if you, I'm assuming at this point you listen to this, you're listening to Raw, not because you don't have any clue who I am or because you need me to win you over to thinking that what I'm going to say is worth listening to. I'm assuming you're listening at this point because you want to know, right? You're curious what I think. And so a little humanity here as well. So Broken was a success by every sense of the term within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which does not make it a success in the world. Keep this in mind. This is so important. If we have a Missouri Synod YouTube star that's getting 1,500 wow views on the YouTubes, well, I'm sorry, but that's kind of pathetic, right? So the best that WeTV ever got, we were still pretty pathetic at the end of the day compared to what was the article I was just interviewed about yesterday with on Issues Etc. There was an interview about an online pastor and an online church he was doing and whatnot, and his numbers were more like in the 4,000 a week, which still, I even reading the article, I'm like, well, dude, I mean, you're not really making waves yet. He might eventually, he'll get some traffic because of the article on the Washington Post. But what turned him on to Twitch TV, which I think Twitch TV is a good thing and worth looking at, that's all in the plan, but what turned him on to Twitch TV was seeing some guy that was just playing video games, and he had 25,000 people viewing him live as he plays a video game, right? Now, that would be more in the realms of beginning or moderate success with internet stuff. So So Worldview Everlasting, I know it's a good thing, and the videos are going to be around. They've helped a lot of people, but we shouldn't confuse it with success, yeah? And neither should we confuse Broken with success. Broken did well within Concordia Publishing House circles, and God bless CPH for what they do. I'm not knocking them necessarily here, but it wasn't on the shelf at Barnes & Noble. It wasn't on the shelf at Costco. It wasn't next to other books that really do well. It was nowhere near a bestseller list of any real kind. If you make number one in Lutheran on Amazon.com, that means you're selling like 25 copies that day. I mean, just do the math on that. 25 copies. It's not a big deal. We're not making waves. We're not breaking barriers. We're not really hitting things hard. But with all that said, that's all big caveat here, right? Because I don't want you to hear me saying Broken was the best thing since sliced bread. I got other complaints about Broken, and it's more complaints about who I was at the time. But Broken, it's Adolf Kaeberle's mysticism, rationalism, and I'm losing here. Mysticism, rationalism, moralism, right? It kind of written for our era. It's good for what it is. It was successful for what it was. And the whole point of bringing that up is, did you notice how long it was until Echo came out? I mean, it was the first year, the second year, the third year, it was 6 years. 6 years. That is absolutely pathetic for somebody who would vouch to say, my primary vocation in life, the desire that I have above all things, I mean, we're going to put the office of the ministry and be a father to my children and a husband to my wife first. I'll put those first. But the thing that I have, the dream of Jonathan Fisk is to be a writer. That is what I went to school to do before I went to seminary. Is that a motorcycle? Wow, look at that. That is what I went to school to do before seminary. My degree is in English with an emphasis in creative writing. When I was 16 years old, I tried to write a book about dragons. Hey, how's this for one? When I was 19 years old going to school, I was writing a story about a man from a futuristic civilization who finds himself lost in like a jungle world that's beneath the civilization, in which there's all of these cat people who are there and they've been kicked out from the civilization and they mount a rebellion against that civilization. And my teacher told me, that's a dumb idea. No one's ever going to buy that. Now, you may never have seen the movie Avatar, but you probably should. It's not a bad movie. And I'm just going to tell you, pagan style, native living cat people fighting against giant machines actually does pretty well. The other book that I tried to write at the time that I think it was my dad at the time said, yeah, that's not going to make sense. It was a love story about a guy who meets a vampire girl and then has to figure out vampire society. And it was more or less, yeah, that's never going to work. And I mean, we're talking, this is years before Twilight. So anyway, not to toot my own horn, right? But I wanted to do this, right? I've always wanted to write. If you follow this podcast, you can go back. You can find Earth. Earth is the book that I am currently writing on for fiction, which has always been a side project. I've never been able to give full attention to fiction writing since I went to seminary. And it's about a third finished. And the audio you can listen to is maybe just a seventh of it or so that's out so far. But I've been plugging away at that thing for maybe 7 years. But plugging away is the wrong term. I've been picking at it. Well, okay. So finding time to write, wanting to write, being a writer, 6 years until your second book comes out after one. The first one's a success. That's pathetic by every stretch of the term. It's a failure. The reason for that was a number of things, partially because the book that my editor and I decided I should write after Broken as a follow-up was not the book I wanted to write at the time. And so we picked something else because it would follow Broken better. And he was right about that. So I'm not saying he was wrong, but it led me on this trail. Or then I tried to kind of do two things at once without really realizing it. You may have heard me tell this story before. I've told this a few places. So I spent like 5 years, like really 5 years, trying to write a book that was two books. And when I finally figured that out, like a surgeon, right, I just went in and I cut out the easier of the two books, just ripped it from the flesh of the other book. And then within a year, you had Echo. Boom, right? It came out. And I was able to just write at it. And I really, I learned a lot about writing. If you want to be a writer, if this is something you want to do, oh, forget that. You want to be a dancer. You want to be an artist. You want to be a whatever. Whatever you want to do and be good at, you got to do it every day, right? And so if you're going to ever complete a book, you got to do it every day. And so I did. I mean, bam, 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 I got that habit down. And even when I transitioned to KFUO, the habit continued. I was able to write every day. It was about an hour, every single day. And that continued after Echo went to CPH, and it took another year for CPH to get it through their process, which is good. That's why there's no typos in it, or not too many at least, things like that. That's where all the art came from. The art was my idea, but they did the drawings and all this stuff. When through that next year, I've been plugging at another book. And I would say, see, looking at this right here now, we're like 2/3 of the way through what I think is a very good draft on this book. A draft that's, when I say very good, good enough that by the time I get to the end of what I'm doing now, I send it to CPH. Like, I don't go back and redraft the whole thing again. I do a lot of draft work while I write. So as opposed to doing, and maybe this is stupid, some people will just do straight through all the way. And you go back and then you just go straight through all the way. But I once I get my main thrust, my main first draft, I go back and spend a lot of time trying to make sure that the thoughts line up. Good writing, in my opinion at least, means that every sentence follows the sentence which came before it. Now, that might sound obvious, and on the page it does do that, but in the brain it doesn't always do that. And it's kind of stunning when you'll like be doing edit work on a page and you'll find a sentence on the bottom of the page that really makes the point you're making on the top of the page in a different paragraph, right? So a lot of time trying to do that and move those things around. And what that does, in theory at least, is it makes the book more readable. It makes, when you say, I couldn't put it down, that's the reason, is it never lets you. Because every next thought was the correct follow-up to the preceding thought. Now, I'm not saying that my writing always does this. I'm saying that that's what I try to do, and that's why I edit the way that I try to edit. So I had been doing this pretty well with this book up until the point when I took a call to Rockford, right? And that was, or what are we looking at now? I accepted that around mid-January. Was it January, February, somewhere in there? And then things just kind of got a little topsy-turvy with life, and it hasn't, I haven't touched it. I think one day, I got one day here since on this book. So this is a very long-winded way of trying to say, today I want to try to kill two birds with one stone. I want to give you something worth listening to on Raw and let you know that I'm here and I intend to keep doing this, and I am so grateful for those of you that are continuing to patronize me, like literally, because it keeps me thinking that it's worth doing. I'm gonna tangent here for a second. At this point in my life, I think I could just step back from all video and audio media stuff and be like, whatever, I don't care, I'm good. I'm going to go in a corner with my cup of coffee, and I'm going to write, and I'm going to be a pastor at St. Paul Rockford, and I'm cool with it. But I don't know that's the right thing to do. That's the introvert in me. That's the shy person in me who just wants to be lazy and a little tired all the time and then just have some free time. Yeah. You know, you guys know Brian Wolfmuller, you know his name at least. He won't let me think that that's a good thing, and I appreciate him for doing that. He calls me regularly. So what's up? What's new? What's the plan? When's it going to start? And he's pushing me on that. And I want to tell you that if you're listening to this right now, if you downloaded it and you've listened this far, then you're in that same camp with Brian. And I'm thanking you for that, that you are keeping me from doing what my nature would do, which is take the easy way and just do only what I want. And you're going to push me to doing what I ought to be doing, which is also what I want. Don't get me wrong. I like the podcasting. I just hate banging my head against a microphone in jack, right? I like having a conversation about scripture with my friend Adam Kuntz and letting other people listen in on it because it's fascinating, right? You gain something out of that. So it's not that I don't want to do it. It's the thorns and the thistles that surround it that are driving me crazy. So thank you for that. Now, I don't remember how I tangented out, but that was a tangent, right? And now we're coming back to the real thing. So what I want to try to do today, as I give you something to listen to and thank you for listening, is also then hit the other stone of, where was I in that book I was writing? Where was I? Because this is the reason you got to write every day. And this is, if you like business stuff or efficiency stuff, this really is the same idea no matter what your discipline is. Whether your discipline is, cooking pasta, or whether your discipline is trying to write the greatest novel ever written. Anything that you do or are doing, when you step away from it, when you step back to it, there is a cost in brain power, mind, and time in getting back to where you were. And if it's just for a few moments, this is why you're not supposed to check your email throughout your day. You should check your email at most 2 times a day. You should empty your inbox when you do it by replying to everybody that you can or forwarding everything that's there that can't be handled to a reference system that you have somewhere else. Now, I'm not saying you got to do this. It's what I try to do. The reason, though, to only go in there once or twice a day is so that you're not distracted from other things that you could be giving more time to. Because if you're in the middle of trying to write, say, a novel, right, a chapter in a novel, and you're getting into that deep thinking and deep work of, oh, this is going good, my juices are flowing, I'm putting it on the paper, and then that notification goes off in the upper right corner of your computer screen or wherever you let your notifications go off. You should turn them off, by the way. And you click on it, and you go look at that email, and it's like, oh, I need to respond to that. And you see there's two more emails there. Oh, I should respond to those too. And you do all that. Now when you go back to where you were writing, your juices aren't flowing anymore, and you have to spend at least 5 minutes, maybe 15 or 20, getting back to where you were so you can just continue what if you just ignored the notification or had them turned off, you could have kept doing without wasting any of that time. And that happens every time you're distracted, right? That happens every time you glance at Facebook for a second. Hey, it happens every time you pick up your phone, right? So those distractions get in the way. Well, it's even more so then if you're doing long-term projecting, long-term writing, and I would imagine this applies to art, I would imagine to a lot of different things. But if you leave off a paragraph or a sentence or maybe even finish a chapter and then you come back the next day, it doesn't take more than 15 or 20 minutes to get back to where you were and keep going. You take off a week, yeah, 15, 20 minutes at least to get back to where you're going. You take off a couple months and man, you don't even really know what you were talking about. So I'm staring at a page right now that says chapters 2 to 3 bodily ins and outs. And I know this much. I know that this is the chapter on 1 Corinthians. So in this book, and I'll tell you kind of what the gist of the book in a moment, but in this book, there is an entire chapter on the book of 1 Corinthians where we go through the book of 1 Corinthians in a very fluid, organic, kind of dancing backwards and sideways way, interweaving direct quotes from the text with words that are explaining or trying to connect the meaning of those quotes to each other, all with a focus on the notion, the idea, the use of the body, really the word body. In the Greek, it's soma. Because in 1 Corinthians, the word body is the heart of the entire book. And if you track the word body through the entire book, you find that out. And you find out that with all the stuff that's going on in Corinth, it's not so good. People sleeping with people they shouldn't sleep with. People getting drunk. People taking each other to court. With all that stuff that's going on, the real issue is that they do not believe the Lord's Supper is the Lord's Supper. They do not believe that the body of Christ is the body of Christ. And the results and effects of not believing that the body is in with and under the bread and wine has an effect on them not believing the body is in with and under them and how they treat each other and how they act in life. And so I were trying in one chapter to show that. So I know that much. Like, it's been several months since I looked at this, but I know that much is going on, right? I'm staring at this page, and I know, so it looks like I've gotten to chapters 2 and 3, but I can see there's plenty of text after that. Before that, what do we got? We got like two segments there. First one's probably, now I don't know this anymore, right? This is what I need to go back and look at. The first segment is probably an introduction to the concept of 1 Corinthians that we're going through it. The second one there is chapter 1, right? And the use of soma and body in chapter 1. Now, this is as a tangent here, but it's kind of where the chapter has to go. It is interesting, the term soma used 46 times by St. Paul in the book of 1 Corinthians doesn't really show up much until I think it's chapter 5 or chapter 6. And so you could make the case that the body language, the body talk is not the main point of the whole book. But that's what I'm trying to show then early on is that even when he's not using the word soma, Paul is very focused on the physical, the tactile, the human, and that means the body-ness of Jesus. And so we spend a lot of time on that, the connection between Jesus' mind and body. We'll talk about that because that's what this chapter 1 section is here. So, but to kind of, before we get there, so we're going back and I'm seeing what kind of where this is in the middle. But since I haven't been here in several months, I pretty much have to go all the way back to the start of the chapter if I'm going to write it, right? I'm not going to do that, you know, while I'm talking to you. I would have to go all the way back to the start of the chapter and pick my way through the entire thing again just to learn where I was. And if you know anything about reading your own writing and caring about what it says or what it sounds like, you don't go back to the start of the chapter and just read it straight through. If you ever want to do that, you need to have your book published first, so that it's like on a printed in a book that you can't change it, and then you'll be able to read it. That's the only time I've ever been able to read my writing without making changes to it. Even if I print it out and just I'm like, I'm just going to only highlight the actual typos. No, I just start writing up and down the side of the page and changing everything. And part of that is that editing thing I was saying earlier, you see the clarifications that can be made and so forth. In that sense, a book is never done. It's only just good enough for someone else to maybe understand what you're saying, all that kind of thing. But what I'll have to do here is I'll go back through the whole chapter, and I'll start immediately tearing it apart to try to make it more clear, partially because, and this is good in a sense, the further away you are from it, the less you remember what you were saying before, the more the words on the page are objectively teaching you what you thought or what you want to have it say. And if it's not clear, you're going to notice it right away. Whereas if you just wrote it yesterday, it's kind of like your baby. You're like, oh, it was so great. I wrote this turn of phrase. It was so cool and people are going to love it, right? And the further away you are from that, the more objective you get in these things. So, all right. So before we just kind of talk about those opening segments, and you're helping me here, right? I'm reviewing this in my head before I actually go back into it by talking to you about it. And hopefully I'll be able to write about it. Probably not this afternoon, but maybe tomorrow. Before we do that, let me just give you the gist of the entire book here as well. And there's a little story behind this. Man, this goes way back. This was the first book I wanted to write when I was out of the seminary. And the reason I wrote Broken was because Scott Kinneman at CPH reached out to me when he learned about Worldview Everlasting. He kind of figured we could capitalize on this guy who's got a little following. He was right about that. He's absolutely right about that. And he said, we need a book about grace. Because there was a book that had come out in Protestantism recently that was supposed to be about grace. And it was sort of like, hey, grace is awesome, so now you be good, right? But they couldn't help themselves as Pietists, Calvinists, legalists, you know, pretty much Roman Catholics. You know, most people can't help themselves. They can't just leave the grace alone sometimes. It's not that there doesn't need to be exhortation or that there is no third use of the law, blah, 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 the inside argument that I'm tired of it, honestly. That's not what I'm saying. I am saying that the power of God to salvation is not the law. It's the gospel. It's the good news of Jesus. It's not that you better be a better person, or even that you can be a better person, or you get to be a better person. None of that's the gospel. And therefore, none of that actually creates nor sustains faith. And so if we're going to talk about grace, then we should just talk about grace and just leave it. No caveat, no if and or but grace. It's done. It is finished for you, right? So we need to write a book kind of in that direction. That's what Broken ended up being. So I had to set aside this other book that I wanted to write at the time. And when I shared earlier in this podcast that after Broken, we were talking about the next book, and I wanted it to be this one that we're going to talk about right now, but he was right. This would not have been a good follow-up to Broken. We needed something more like Broken, and I think Echo kind of is a nice middle ground in that regard. It really has served its purpose well, and God willing, it's helped you. I've said this before, it's one of the best things I've ever done in any way, but so now I'm coming back to this book again, which I had originally wanted to write way, way back. This is like 2006, right? This is like 12 years ago. Dear Lord. I was sitting on my patio, my porch. Man, what a year that was. I was called to New Jersey to be a mission revitalizer, which is a disastrous idea of sending a guy into a congregation of 25 people that had previously been a congregation of 150 people just a few years prior, and thinking that you're going to fix it by more or less ignoring them and starting something new in the same building. It just didn't work well at all, and I was without a call within 9 months. And a long story, a lot of pain. Don't need to go into it too much, but we ended up moving away from that town. We had a little bit of an income from the district. They felt guilty enough about the situation that they were willing to keep me on income. I think we had like a 9-month stipend. You know, every month would come in. I was looking for a call. This is how I ended up in Philadelphia, is because that was close by. I ended up preaching down there, but we'd moved to this nice little town. I really liked it, Alpha, New Jersey. Right on the border, western border of New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And we had this shotgun condo apartment place. And my wife doesn't like the memories of this place. I loved it because you could open the front window and the back window of the house, and the breeze would just run straight through the entire house. It was just such a wonderful thing. And wonderful, the weather out there really is very nice in the summer times. And so I was sitting outside in the summertime on an evening, and this is, I guess because I wasn't really working in a sense. That's a different story. I still was hungry enough to want to use my off hours for some theology, and so I was reading through Herman Sasse's Lonely Way, Volume 2. Herman Sasse is one of the most formulative theologians for me personally as an individual. I would list them, honestly, and a lot of people aren't going to like this. I would say that Gerhard Fürthe, good and ill, I don't agree with everything he ever wrote. He's wrong about some very important things. But in terms of early formation of law and gospel, Gerhard Fürthe is hugely formative on me. And then right with him and or after him, and maybe, you know, the reason why it's all worked out so well is that Sasse came right on his heels. And Sasse has his own neat story in its own way, but I was reading this collection of Sasse writings, Lonely Way. It's got two volumes that has been compiled by a doctor, reverend, pastor, president, Matthew Harrison. And the work of Dr. Ronald Feuerhahn as well was largely a part of that. It's just a bunch of essays that he wrote during his life as a teacher under or in the midst of Nazi Germany. He was not a Nazi. He was very anti-Nazi, but he was a German living there during that time. He was a Lutheran. And he wrote open letters to large groups of pastors. He wrote articles for journals. I mean, he was doing the work of a theologian of the church, kind of like a seminary professor would be doing today. And one of the articles, though, was more or less about how at that time, the movement called the German Christian movement, which was the Nazis' sort of church infiltrating movement. They didn't go into church and say, we're the Nazi church now. They said, we're the German Christian church, right? And the German on the front end of that, the Nazis were all about paganism, right? They were all about German nationalism. And so they began moving in and taking over the churches politically through this German Christian movement. By the way, the church growth movement is not Nazism, but it is fascism as a philosophy and not an entirely different kind of thing, right? Under the radar by changing the terms. Anyhow, he was talking about how during this German Christian movement rise, it was looking more and more bleak for the church. That the historic forms or expectations of Christianity that you would find in the church were vanishing from the midst of the church, and that this was beginning to look disastrous as a whole for Christians and for Christianity. And then recognizing that and calling that out for what it is, he then makes the case that the church can never perish, based on the fact that the body of Jesus can never perish, and the body of Jesus is already risen from the dead, and the body of Jesus is the church, right? That the moment he rises on Easter Sunday, he is the church. We talk about the church being born on Pentecost. Well, sort of, but no, it was born on the eighth day when Jesus walked out of the tomb. He now is the new man, and church and Christian is everything that's just connected to him, the new man, one body who is Jesus Christ. And then Sasse turns and makes the point that along with this, I will build my church, the church will never perish, I am the church. Jesus also turns and says, take and eat, this is me, right? Take and eat, this is my body. And that this theology of the Lord's Supper is the confidence and the substance of that church going forward through time and space and history. Now, Sasse is probably best known for his work on the Lord's Supper, and I'm losing the name of it now. I think it's just called the Lord's Supper. It's a monumental, you know, tome of a thing, total history of all arguments you could ever find about the Lord's Supper, and kind of masterfully done. But this article had a way of not just going back and doing all the history of everybody everywhere, but of painting the struggle to survive as church in a hard age, in a very lively and what I felt was compelling way. It spoke to me, this young man sitting on a patio smoking a cigar on a Friday night in the middle of 21st century America. I thought he was writing to me like he was there with me. That's what it felt like. But I also knew that there was one challenge with this. And that challenge is that I had been trained theologically, so there were a lot of terms and thinking and turns of phrase in the way he wrote, which I could read, but not everybody would really want to read. It's not that you couldn't if you didn't want to sit down and do the work, but you know, you ever picked up something that a lawyer has been working on for you? You ever seen a legal document? And you know, you get about three sentences in and you're like, I think I could make sense of this 15-page document if I really wanted to. But why don't I just ask the lawyer what it means? Right? And it's just a little bit easier. Why don't you tell me what it says? Than reading all the legal speak itself. Well, it's not that highfalutin theological scholastic work is like that on purpose in a negative way. I don't think the lawyers speak is quite like that in a negative way either. But it is technical language, right? It's a learned language. And so I knew, or I believe, that essay from Sasse, it's never going to be on every shelf in every Lutheran's home in America. It's just not going to be, let alone, you know, being picked up by evangelical cuckoo heads who are starving for the gospel because they've lost it, chasing after who knows what and whatever new revival, new measure movement they're in most recently, video games or what have you, right? And so they're not going to pick it up. So how can I take that experience I had, which made it all click, much of my life and theological formation for the previous 6 years probably clicked when I read that essay and was like, oh, it's about the Lord's Supper. You know, how can I take that moment and bring it forward to our time now, the same way that, God willing, I brought Adolf Kaberle's quest for holiness forward in the book Broken? And so from there, I started working on this recapitulation of Sasse's essay, which over time has become less and less just a restating of his essay and more its own piece, its own work. In it then, I don't know if I'd have to go, I don't know at this point, this is part of the problem, it's been so long, I don't know what chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 are about, but I do know that it is about building the case that I just kind of laid out before, that the beating heart of the church in its life is the Lord's Supper, and we can see this historically. We can even see this in the present. This is kind of an amazing, amazing point here, that for all of the divisions that are in the church right now, the division between me and Joel Osteen, let's just use our buddy Joel as the example here, right? Joel and I are about as far apart on the theological spectrum as you can get, to the level where I might even question whether or not he's a full-blown, actual, out-of-heaven heretic. Now, because this is a public podcast, Joel, if you're listening, I'd rather have that conversation with you before I decry you that way. I do think your teaching's deadly and dangerous and you're deeply deceived, and I got no problem saying that. We're as far apart as you can possibly get, and you might be going to hell, right? Okay, so while that is true, or at least I will make the assertion that it's true, if you go to Joel Osteen's church for a full year every Sunday, at some point, they will bring out some bread, and they will bring out some fruit of the vine, which sadly is not wine, but nonetheless is almost wine. And they got the bread. They'll bring out the bread. And then they will talk about Jesus' words on the night he was betrayed in some way, twisted, erroneous, heterodox as the day is long. And then they'll eat the bread and they'll drink the fruit of the vine, which isn't wine, right? Now, I'm not trying to say that it's so good that they're doing it the way that they're doing it. What I'm trying to say is, isn't it gnarly and stunning and all-powerful that the guy who on the night he was betrayed said, do this, for someone as far away from me as Joel Osteen, he's still doing it, right? And that's Sasse's point, that as divided as we are, the supper is still uniting us, if in no other way than as a ritual which we've received from Jesus. And then the point that is to be made is that it's actually in many more ways than just as a ritual, right? That when you have the Orthodox teaching on it, when you don't tinker with the words, it is a much bigger unity than a mere remembrance and a mere symbol. But the symbol itself is quite powerful. And even to the level of nearly unstoppable. The only way it stops is that you stop being part of the Christian church altogether, right? And we do make that kind of a statement, right? That the time when you would stop having the Lord's Supper in church is when you're no longer the church in any way, shape, or form. So while I'll go as far as I said about Joel Osteen, that I'm deeply concerned for his faith, ultimately, yeah? I will not say that there are no Christians who go to his church. Not until they deny the creed and stop baptizing people in the name of the Father, Son, and Spirit and stop having the Lord's Supper be brought out. And at any point when they decide that these things are not to be done, like when the Quakers decided, nope, the Lord's Supper is not made for us to repeat. It was a one-time thing. We should wash feet instead, right? Okay, now you're not the church. Like you're just done being the church. We can question how much of church is present, how weak and frail and maybe Babylonian captivityed the church is in these radical places. And I'm at the point where I'll also say I'm just not so sure until you walk in and listen anymore, because you don't know when the last time Jesus crucified was even mentioned. Maybe it was years and years ago. Yeah. But it is kind of stunning. It is kind of amazing. It's miraculous even that for all the things that people do let go of, it's awful hard for even the most heterodox church to stop bringing out bread and Jesus' words. They still do it. And to stop baptizing. We can make the same case about baptism. So that's one of the early points that Sosa makes that I want to pick up in this book. Hopefully it picks up, brings it forward. Talking also about the power of words and how... I don't want to go off into this one too much here, but how we, in our somewhat enlightenment, 18th century scientific minded arrogance, think less of words than we ought. And this is still going with the postmodernism end of words stuff that we kind of talked about a few weeks ago in this podcast. But words are not nothing. They are air. If you think air is nothing, well, then stop breathing it, and you've never seen what the wind can do. You know, they're not just air, though. They're also sound, and sound is not nothing. Sound is a powerful, powerful thing. It can move you, not just in the sense of your heart and your feelings and your emotions, but the way that sound works is that it literally moves you. So we will go into this a little bit here. So I love this idea. Right now, I don't know how you're listening. You're either on your car stereo or you probably got earbuds on, something like that, which you shouldn't feel too bad. You can walk around all day with your earbuds on if you want. I'm cool with that. maybe you're listening on your stereo at home and it's like you got a couple people with you listening, but however it's happening, this is marvelous in so many ways. I'm not even there, and I'm not even talking right now, right? I'm talking either earlier today or a week ago or something like that into this machine on my table here. Machine meaning, I don't even know how this thing works. Somehow the electricity is capturing my voice. What is my voice? Oh, we got to back up. To do this, I'm sending air over a muscle and a bit of tendon in my throat, and while the air is going up, I'm also vibrating it, you know, like a cat purring, vibrating it. And that's all happening because electrical pulses are running from my brain down my spinal cord to these muscles to bend them in various directions fastly all at once, so that what I have in my head, which is a thought, which is also a chemical reaction flying across these neurons in the middle of my head, so that thought would come and become and turn itself into these sounds, these noises, this audible thing that's formed and shaped by my mouth to have hisses and puffs and tuss on it, right? And for me, in my head, this language, this tongue, it means something, and that... But that's not what's going across the microphone here. There's no meaning going into the microphone. There's just these sounds, right? This rumbling from my voice box. That's going into more electricity down and then apparently into the mic input jack. And it would seem, I'm looking at the wave file as it's being made, it looks like it's actually recording. So somehow in bytes, you know, in ones and zeros, it's all being kept track of. And then I'm going to save it. I'm going to upload it as this MP3 thing. You're going to get it. You're going to be listening to it. And we'll skip the technology side of it. It's all coming out of your speaker. I don't really know how the speaker makes the sound. But what then is happening is that those tuffs and puffs and grrs and ahs and all that is coming together and flying through the air as kind of a different types of wave, different lengths of a wave. You can't see a wave. They're more of a force than a substance, but they are substantial. Yeah, you can't try to stand against a wave in the beach if it's a big one. You'll find out that it's substantial. Now the wave's moving the water, but the wave's moving the water, right? So it's doing something. So this wave is flying through the air, however far it's got to go. If it's your earbud, it's pretty close, into your ear. and running up the canal, and it's hitting this bit of skin that's there. We call it the eardrum, right? And the eardrum, as it hits it, is like a dish, or like, you ever hold like a washcloth under the sink and you see it, like the water will go through it, but it also like catches on it too, and it'll kind of wobble a little bit. Okay, well, that's what's happening to your eardrum, is the sound is hitting the eardrum and it's making it wobble. And right on the backside of that eardrum is one little bone. I used to make fun of my wife because she would talk about your ear bones. I'm like, there's no bones in your ear. It's all cartilage. Well, that's not entirely true. You actually got bones in your ear. There's three of them. The first one is the little one that's attached to the inside of the eardrum. And then it's kind of leaned against another one, and it's leaned against another one. So that when the eardrum moves, those bones kind of go up and down in like a little, I don't know, I'm like making hand motions as if you can see them, a little serpentine wavy pattern. You know how when like you see guys will do the dance, breakdance thing, and like they get on the ground and they like do this like little floppy thing where their face goes up like a U curve and it comes down and then it goes all the way through their body, right? Kind of like that. It's happening with these bones in your ear. And on the last one, it kind of, each one of those bones kind of minimizes the movement. The movement gets smaller and smaller, but it's moving. Like this is how we got to this. It's literally moving you. The sound is literally moving you inside your head right now. And that's before you've understood it. It's just still, it's going to get to the understanding. So that last bone is connected to a nerve that somehow is translating the final little movements of that teeny tiny bone, infantile movements, right? So small, but picking up the puffs and the tuffs and the gurs and the r's, and turning it into another electrical pulse with a signal within that electrical pulse, the way you'd send something over the internet. And it's running back up your neck and into your brain, and then there it's being received by these neurons. Neurons in the brain are kind of like little flux capacitors. I don't know really what to call them. They're transmission devices, and they line up in big super highways made of them, and they send these electrical pulses through them. It's all involving salts and chemicals and fats and all this stuff. You need fats in your diet so your brain will work, right? You need these fats because it's all being done in this chemistry event in your head, which then as that's happening, the sound that I'm making here now is taking the meaning that is in my mind, and it's putting it in your mind. That is marvelous. That is not nothing. It's a physical reality. And this is kind of the point, right? Words are a physical reality. So when somebody says something like how it's impossible for Jesus to be the bread and wine in the Lord's Supper because physical things and spiritual things can't hold the same space, I would submit to you that they just don't have a clue how anything works. And they're working on a 17th century level view of Newtonian physics. You know, say 18th century. You know, they just haven't figured out that, no, it works this way all the time. Words work this way. And this is, so before we even get to the Lord's Supper side of it, to have the mind of Christ, as Paul talks about at the start of 1 Corinthians, is to have the chemical firing pattern that was running through Jesus' head as the infleshed Word of God travel through guttural sounds and then other people's vocal boxes and then also onto pen and paper down through history until those same chemical explosions, same pattern of chemical explosions is happening in your head. So to have the mind of Christ is not merely to like what he said or agree. It's actually to have your brain physically shaped, not just like his, but by his. And again, that's just a stunning thing, the power of words. So then you take that power of words by themselves and you push that forward to them being not just man's words. We're just talking about man's words. What happens when it's God's words and God's spirit, which through words has always been a creative force, going back to the early part of Genesis and so forth, when that is attached to these things coming down through time and space and across the waves to you? And then what happens when those words start saying they're going to do things even above and beyond what words normally do? Yeah? That is, in theory, just the setup for the case that I'm making or going to make in this book, that God willing will be called the Word without flesh. Let me double check this here. Yeah, the Word without flesh. I'm still working on the subtitle, so I don't know. You got two edges here, right? You could subtitle it what it's really about, or you could subtitle it something that makes it sound like it follows Echo and Broken. So, like, the current working subtitle is The Word Without Flesh, Lost Echo of a Broken Church. It's fine, right? It sounds like it's a follow-up, and it is a little bit. But the original subtitle was this. It was The Word Without Flesh, Why Christianity is Dying Even Though Jesus is Still Alive. I'm still more compelled by that. I don't know if I'm convinced I should. The marketing will work better. I just know it will, and that's what's frustrating, right? The title is better if it's the real title, but it's not going to sell as well, which means less people will read it, and it's just the title, and we want you to read it so that you get it, so that you should push it forward, right? That's how theology works. So the marketing matters. Anyway, the Word Without Flesh. And the goal here is to recognize that it when you lose, as Sasse did, for this German Christian movement and the Nazi movement taking over the church, and how this was all a result of earlier movements that had basically made devoid an understanding of the supper as physical reality for them. Lutheranism was not the dominant way of thinking about Christianity in the decades and even century leading up to the Nazi movement. It was there was some Lutheran in name only stuff, but it was a unionized church, and it was the Calvinist view of the Lord's Supper, and even a really weakened view of that, that was the dominant thing, the union view of the Lord's Supper. Recognizing that when you lose the real view, everything else eventually goes with it. Everything. So if we're sitting here looking at American Christianity saying, what's wrong with the church? There's all but guaranteed to be one answer. We don't believe in the body of Christ, with all the levels of meaning that carries from his resurrection to his supper to you and me being absolutely one flesh with him by means of that supper. And the goal is to make the case of that, not only intellectually, as I've kind of been doing, but from scripture itself. And so that's where this chapter 8 then is, after all the setup, all the preparing for why this matters. The back end of the book is, in one chapter, we go all the way through 1 Corinthians with an attention to the Lord's Supper's theology. In the next chapter, we go all the way through the Gospel of John with an attention to the Lord's Supper's theology. And then I think we're going to also glance at, in the next chapter, 1 John and 2 John with an attention to the Lord's Supper theology. And that's pretty much the book. It'll be done. That's why it's so frustrating I can't touch it, because I'm really not that far away from the end of the dang thing. But it's just been a... Well, reminding myself what it's about, right? To get back to it, that's been the challenge and so forth. So let's see here. What do we got? We got about 5 minutes here. Why don't we just see what happens if I go and I read a little bit of this to you? I don't know. I don't know if I should do that. This is chapter 8. So we're in the middle of the book. I'll go ahead and read it. We'll see. You can tell me, because if we get bored, then obviously it's not very good, right? So. A little segment here called Before There Were Scriptures. Until Christians had a fight over the Lord's Supper, there was no New Testament. For decades, the fledgling Church of Jesus existed with the New Testament only in oral form. This was not a problem. The apostles all preached the same truth. With the Old Testament firmly in hand, their didache, their teaching, was the same in all the congregations they founded. This didache, this teaching, was doctrine, clear enough and memorable enough to confidently leave as a pattern of sound words for pastors ordained into the task of echoing it. It wasn't until some began teaching different doctrine, heterodidache, or heterodoxy, different doctrine, that conflicts arose which compelled the apostles to start writing down the orthodidache, the orthodoxy, or the straight doctrine. The first such recorded conflict happened around 48 AD, and described by St. Luke in his History of the Acts of the Apostles, written around 62 AD. Here's the typo, I found a typo, and is described by St. Luke, yeah, in 62 AD. So it happens in 48, but it's written in 62. The spread of Christianity into non-Jewish peoples created enough friction that a council was held at Jerusalem to wrestle with the difference between the true didache,
and cultural traditions from the Old Covenant. After the council heard both Peter and James speak in unison with Paul, a letter was sent to all Christians encouraging freedom on those things neither commanded nor forbidden by the Lord himself. The letter insisted steadfastness on all things commanded, while also encouraging patience with those who might have trouble telling the difference. Interestingly, even though we know this letter was received and accepted by the churches, to our knowledge, none of the congregations which received it treated it as scripture. Apart from Luke's work to catalog it, the letter itself was not copied, copied again, passed on, handed down, nor canonized in and of itself. The first writing to receive such sacred treatment came 7 years after the council, around the year 55 AD. At that time, while St. Paul was living in Ephesus as part of his third missionary journey, words of trouble came to him about a congregation he'd planted in an eclectic port town across the sea. He'd spent over a year in Corinth during his second missionary journey, having embarked almost immediately following that council back in 48. He developed strong ties with them while working as a tent maker and a leather worker, and he'd looked forward to a return visit, but he was also finding much fruitful work in Ephesus, so he delayed. Besides, he knew that the excellent preacher Apollos had gone on to Corinth, having been partially trained in Ephesus by the former Corinthian members Aquila and Priscilla. But now, a group of three men had arrived from Corinth seeking Paul, bearing a financial gift as well as a letter from a woman named Chloe. In it would seem, she detailed evidences of various heterodidache, quickly rifting the Corinthian congregation into competing factions. It had gone so far as to even derail the weekly practice of receiving communion together. This disturbed Paul, as you might imagine. The chaotic upheaval in Corinth was nothing to be pleased with, but worse, the fact that their schism had disrupted the Lord's Supper could only come as a massive shock. I'm going to fix a little typo there. For decades, churches had sprung up from Jerusalem to Judea to the ends of the earth without the Bible. They gathered week in and week out to hear the preaching of the apostles' didache from the Old Testament scriptures. Certainly, the proclamation of Jesus as risen from the dead was the heart of the New Testament, even if none of it was written yet. But just as powerful an element in the equation was the New Testament in his blood, the heartbeat of doing this in remembrance of him. From Pentecost onward, every single congregation of Christianity started its congregating expressly in order to eat this meal. But now this mark of Christian identity and fellowship was being superseded by banners of sexual license, idol toleration, and prophetic interruption, with this new commandment lost in the shuffle. It should not be missed that it was this fight that first gave us the New Testament scriptures. Suddenly, the Paul who had written zero inspired words for posterity ceased his mere planning another visit after passing through Macedonia. Ceased his planning. Another visit after passing through Macedonia wasn't going to cut it. This situation called for more than some spiritual gift. With the supper itself all but destroyed among them, as he says later, it is not the Lord's Supper that you eat. It was time for the word of the Lord to once again be written down. For the first time since the prophet Malachi, inerrant pen was put to paper, lest a virus infect the churches once and for all. There you go. That's what we call eisegetics. Yeah, the knowledge around the book of 1 Corinthians. It's not all of it. We know more than what I've shared there, but hopefully put in a bit of a storytelling way in a way that makes it interesting. Now, does that seem real? I was happy with that. I felt good about that. It's kind of weird. As a writer, you kind of have a different response sometimes to your writing. Sometimes you read it and you're like, man, that was bad. and sometimes you read it and you're like, oh, that was really good. But that doesn't mean that that's actually true, right? So your own opinion of your own baby isn't always objective. And so I thought that was all right, right? And so, it's good. So what would be next would be kind of moving into chapter one, total mind body. Yeah, good. So I don't know how you're feeling about today. If you're still listening to this thing, I thank you very much. Hopefully you've gotten a few things out of it here or there, but you've inspired me. We did hit the two birds with one stone. And, Looks like the microphone in jack works so far. It's still not where I need it to be. This is so frustrating. We'll get there. Pray for me. I meant that when I said it earlier, even though I don't like the juju magic side of it, but pray for me. That I'll figure out how to get this tech stuff together, because I really want to get to some of these interviews. I want to do some interviews, but I hope you've enjoyed this look at me as a writer and also what might be coming next. Feel free to send encouragement my way and say, write that book. It won't necessarily help, but it'll be nice to see that somebody cares. And that's a really terrible way to end a show, but it's over now.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going. And in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes. And check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.